ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Just 40 years ago, racism was legal in South Africa.
You were a non-person. You were non-white.
I'm Sisonke Msimang. My dad was a freedom fighter against apartheid, and I grew up as part of a global movement to end that injustice. But I don't know much about what Australians did. So join me as I meet the Aussies who took a stand and helped change world history. ABC Rewind, Boycott. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello there, welcome to the Minefield. A somewhat normal version of it, I guess. Oh boy, that has been a long story. Well, Laird Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host as we try to negotiate the ethical and moral dilemmas of modern life. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Waleed. This feels weird, doesn't it?
It feels very weird. The background of this show, well, some of it's obvious. We've just done the Ramadan series. We do that every year. The point of the Ramadan series is we don't pay attention to the world. Meanwhile, Scott, I don't know.
Well, I mean, can I just mention two things that feel particularly strange to me?
Yeah.
I mean, the sheer tonnage of what's happened over the last 4 weeks is kind of hard to get one's arms around. We're going to do our best. But this also feels strangely reminiscent of all sorts of things that we had already been talking about before we engaged in this break, in this deepening, let's call it. We were looking at forms of warmongering and territorial ambition that were being executed by the United States in June last year. We were talking about the relative impotence of international law in constraining the declarations of war, even war in self-defense. So in many respects, it kind of feels like deja vu all over again, doesn't it? It feels like we're returning back, we're circling back to the same point, and yet at the same time, there's so much that's deeper, there's so much that's different, and there's so much that I don't want to speak for both of us, but I certainly find much more concerning.
Right. Well, no doubt we'll get to that. Of course, the thing we're gesturing towards there quite specifically is the war in Iran that has commenced during Ramadan. And so, I mean, that's another theme of this, by the way, is that these things keep happening in Ramadan. The last Ramadan was the ceasefire in Gaza ended.
That's right.
And I remember that moment because it was an especially heartbreaking thing when you're going through, like in my case, you're doing Ramadan yourself, and then you see that happen and you know what that would mean in a moment like that. I mean, what it would mean at any moment, frankly, but in a moment like that. The previous Ramadan, of course, had been...
No ceasefire.
Yeah. So there's something about this yearly rhythm of these things sort of unfolding in this way. I still stand by the fact that we did what we did and we did take that step out. And in some ways, it helps us a little bit in talking about... In some ways, it doesn't help because everything has just become so much more convoluted and so much bigger. And getting our arms around it is, I think, the right metaphor for trying to talk about it. But in another way, when a war like this occurs, and there is something singular about this particular war, even as it echoes so many that have happened before, there's something about not responding immediately and having things unfold in a particular way and the shape of things becoming clearer or in some ways less clear, and that being the point, that, I don't know, we can take advantage of that at the very least. So with that said, I don't know where you want to start here, Scott, because, and I know we've spoken about this off air as well, which is how do we talk about the war in Iran? And it just seemed that there were a trillion entry points, and for that reason, any one of them just seemed inadequate. So I'm going to give you the hospital pass here. what's your way in?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, I'm not sure either. It is the very fact that there is a troubling pattern that is being repeated here that stands the very real risk of spreading, of not just broader, widespread global consequences. And in many respects, I think the further global consequences, say the economic consequences on the price of fuel, these are things that we're going to be reckoning with later. But I think elevating those to a position of moral prominence is kind of an act of bad faith. It feels to diminish the moral consequences of war itself. I suppose one of the things that really strikes me right from the outset, Waleed, is that whereas the strikes that the United States and Israel engaged in order to deal what was purported to be irreparable or devastating damage to Iran's nuclear capabilities in June last year, and to decapitate, that was the word, you remember, that was being used, to decapitate some of its senior leadership and some of its senior nuclear scientists, the merit that those particular strikes had is that they were contained. It was meant to be immediately devastating. It was meant to be relatively precise. It was supposed to be a kind of in and out without any kind of risk of there being further either region-wide consequences or a long, drawn-out military affair.
I would say that was broadly true, and probably more at Trump's hand than at Netanyahu's, because there were also weird little signs.
Right. That's right.
As I recall, I'm doing this now from memory because I wasn't anticipating to talk about this, but there were certain things hit in Tehran, for example, that aren't entirely consonant with just going after the nuclear sites and things like that.
That's right.
So there were kind of signs, and we've known this about Benjamin Netanyahu for years, that he's very keen to take on the regime, he's very keen to get rid of it. I'm not saying that's what he was up to in that particular moment, but the idea that this would be entirely constrained, there was always a sense of him resisting against that or pulling against that. And Donald Trump comes along with his bunker-busting bomb eventually after, you know, effectively being talked into joining that war. He drops the bomb and then says, right, it's over now.
Mm. There was also a certain eagerness to flex, though. I mean, that was absolutely prominent, in much the same way that we've seen him follow up on that desire to militarily flex with the capture of Nicolás Maduro in Venezuela. Yes. There is a...
Which I think is related to what's happening
There is a raw desire to assert power and a certain belief in, a certain confidence in, the impregnability, the irresistibility of the U.S. military to do what it wants to do. This now has been, I think, particularly channeled through the muscular chest-beating rhetoric of Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth, where his regular, repetitious boasts of absolute U.S. supremacy over the airwaves, over the air over Tehran, the absolute supremacy of United States military might to do what it wants, and therefore the abject desperation of Iran. It's just a matter of time before they're going to give in and give up. So these are all things that are very much, I think, in many respects, of a piece. The extra element here, though, Waleed, that I'll confess sends a shiver. It's one of the many things that really concerns me. At the outset of this current rash of hostilities, you know, we've seen 3 months' worth of vibrant, vital, in many respects, extremely courageous protests on the part of Iranian citizens, the large portions of the Iranian population, against the Islamic regime. These protests are very much of a piece with the rolling series of intermittent protests that have been going on over the last 3 years. They are largely secular. They are very much focused both on the tyrannical nature and also the religious heavy-handedness of the Islamic Republic regime. And in the lead-up to the current rash of hostilities, Donald Trump's address directly to the protesters, "We have your back. Soon, your government, your nation will be yours for the taking." There was something about the recklessness of that. I think in some degree, it was even worse than Barack Obama's infamous drawing of a red line on the use of chemical weapons in Syria, and then his inability, his refusal to follow up with military reprisal. there was something here that was seemingly off the cuff. It may have even been good-natured or had good intentions. But there was something about the recklessness of that and the holding out of a degree of false hope that almost certainly led to mass casualties at the hands of the Islamic Republic regime. And in many respects, even a kind of crushing of the very possibility of the hopes for democratic reform that are still held on to both by citizens within Iran and also members of the Iranian diaspora. There's something about that entire confluence, I think, of events that has led to this easy slippage. I'm not sure if you've recognized it. I have no doubt that you have. This easy slippage from clear conversations about the legality versus the illegality of declarations of war, of the conduct of war. It should be said that there's been no formal declaration of war. There's something about that that needs to be discussed. But an easy slippage from the language of the legality of acts of war to the legitimacy of striking this regime. These are bad people. This is a tyrannical regime. These are merciless killers of their own population. Who is going to defend these people should we strike them? When there's that kind of slippage from legality to the language of, for want of a better term, morality, and then when that's followed up by the unrestrained language of military might, we can, therefore we will, it seems to me that there's something there. When you then couple that with the desperation of the plight of Iranian citizens on the ground, there's something there that makes this, and this isn't even getting to the regional conflict, there's something there that I think makes this really quite desperate.
A couple of things to add to that. One is, I wouldn't describe actually the protests we saw in January as being largely secular. I mean, maybe that's true, but the thing that set them apart for me was just how pervasive they were across the country.
Sure,
These were not sort of secular elites in Tehran rising up for reasons to do with, I don't know, headscarves or something like that. This was across the country. This included people in rural areas who would not really have had any truck with those sort of more secularly minded Iranians, whatever, because of just how dire the economic situation had become. And so it was probably the first time I'd seen an uprising of any sort against the Iranian regime that felt like it might be really going somewhere.
Because of its broad base, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think one of the mistakes that is very easy to make sitting in Western chairs watching these sort of things is we project, and certainly, you know, politicians do this and certain kinds of political analysts and commentators do this, they project their own understanding of what a person would want.
True.
That is a reflection of themselves onto whoever is living under whatever regime is evil, right? Mm. Of course they just want to be like us. Of course they want to live our lives. And of course they want, yeah.
This is Iraq all over again.
Yeah. We see this all the time. And you know, I don't really know there's a way around saying this without just not saying anything. Americans are especially prone to this, but Australians, you know, for what it's worth, and it's probably not worth much, but Australians have this problem as well. In some ways, it's a natural human phenomenon, but when you understand the societies on their own terms, you see they're incredibly complex. There are all sorts of currents and countercurrents. There are still people within Iran that would support the regime. It might be 15, 20%, something like that. So there's all these complexities. And for that reason, when you see protests erupt in a country, one of the laziest things you can do, and often one of the most misleading things to do, is to say, that's the voice of the whole people, and they all think this, and they all want this. But in the case of those January protests, that was closer to the truth than was the case in other ones, right?
That's very, very well said. I probably should have said it was an anti-theocratic protest. Strictly speaking, secular.
I think it might even be broader than that, though. Because at some point when it becomes just about, I don't have the money to live anymore, you're not even asking questions about theocracy versus whatever.
You get into the realm of corruption, yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, that's one thing. But that also, I think, underscores the point you make about Trump's rhetorical intervention. You know, take back your government. The phrase that everyone seems to like using, your liberation is at hand. Like these sorts of things. That lands in a different way when you're talking about protests that really were that broad, that really were that diverse. You're right, though, to fix on this constant reference of or a constant reference to the regime as being evil and therefore the bad guys. The problem I have with this is, first of all, we hear this quite a lot. We heard that in the lead up to Iraq, etc. Secondly, I'm not here to defend the regime.
No.
And often what it's doing is making an argument no one's having, or picking an argument no one's having, in order to assert a conclusion that is highly contestable, right? Mm. And my problem with any kind of invocation of the evil of the regime here is it's doing far too much work. You want evil regimes? They're a dime a dozen. We can probably go through the world, and if we have enough knowledge about it, we could probably pick endlessly over them. We don't then just launch military action against them for very good reason. One is then you end up in this endless argument over who gets to decide what constitutes an evil regime and the circumstances under which they can just be bombed. But more relevantly, it doesn't mean that bombing it will fix it. Mm. It doesn't mean that you will end up with a better regime or that the regime won't survive and become more repressive. So, in other words, by leading with, no, not even leading, beginning and ending with the idea that this is an evil regime, you avoid the most important questions, which are, is what you're doing going to help? And can you actually do it?
Mm-hmm.
And so to say nothing then of precedents, you know, legal and moral or whatever, about military intervention. And then that's why the Hegseth stuff that you noted is really interesting. We're talking in a week where Donald Trump has done some extraordinary things in this war. He's asked China for military assistance in opening the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians utterly predictably have shut down, which is choking oil supply around the world and causing havoc with prices, which Australians, for example, are seeing turn up at the petrol pump yeah. in their local area, all of which was utterly predictable. So he's gone as far as asking China for help. He's gone to his European allies, NATO allies, and asked them for help, and they've rebuffed him. And the ease with which they've rebuffed him is its own telling story. And then when they've said no, he's done that thing that Donald Trump very often does and goes, well, we didn't want you anyway,
mm-hmm.
and I never needed you, and we're the most powerful country in the world. And so, and that's very much the Hegseth thing.
Yeah.
And this is part of, before you even get to questions of moral legitimacy here, this is the, it seems, ineradicable disease that lies at the heart of so many military adventures, especially American ones, which is to say that because this is a nation that is the most powerful on earth, that has no peer in the sense of no nation that can match it pound for pound in a military sense. I think the last thing I saw was its military spending outweighs the military spending of the next nine countries combined or something like that, right? Because of that, which is a relative claim, it's the most powerful. It wants to make an absolute claim about we can do whatever we want and we can achieve whatever goals we happen to have. And then that's before you get to the other point, which you hadn't mentioned, but I think casts a terrible moral pall over this. And that is that there don't even seem to be clear stated aims anyway. So what you're left with is what international law would call an act of aggression, a completely illegal military act on the basis of an ill-conceived notion of American power that doesn't seem to have a solid justification beyond the fact that they're the bad guys, with no aims.
Mm-hmm.
And here I talk specifically of American aims. There are clearly Israeli aims. But on the American side of the equation, there's, what are they? They keep changing. There are all sorts of contradictory things being floated.
I mean, there is one that is both interesting and, to me, profoundly troubling. There is a moment in the writing of Ugo Grotius, one of the fathers, one of the sort of philosophical figures behind international law, where he explains that if one's rival in a territory is weak and one has a vested interest in remaining relatively strong, it is no justification in war or for war to then wage war on a weaker opponent such that that opponent is incapable of presenting some form of rivalry, some challenge to one's own territorial dominance.
So just maintain supremacy through, well, mowing the grass.
That's precisely right. Now, that is the justification. You know, one of the things that's been almost vertiginous over the last year is, what is it? Is Iran immensely, powerfully strong, an imminent or intolerable threat, to use Trump's most recent language? Is it just around the corner from developing nuclear warheads or ICBMs that can reach the continental United States? Is it immensely strong and therefore it needs to be kind of cut down at the knees? Or is it in a position of vulnerability and weakness, and this is the right moment to strike? Either way, there is something here that is both legally and, it seems to me, morally troubling about the idea of the necessity, the moral imperative, the strategic imperative of keeping, again, nobody here is trying to defend the Iranian regime. There are all sorts of things here that I think are morally, politically, geopolitically repulsive. But to use the justification that it is better to keep a weak opponent down to ensure they can't get back up again, it's better to act preemptively in order to establish one's position of unrivaled regional dominance. On both counts, it's really troubling just how quickly both the language of legality but also the underlying moral basis for the language of legality is cast aside.
But even if I were prepared to go along with that sort of justification, you can only really make that sort of claim when your strategic imperatives and your planning of the war are meticulous enough that you know exactly the nature of your supremacy and power and what the geopolitical consequences are likely to be. And this is why I'm saying, look, you don't have to go this far to say that this is a morally compromised war. But I'm saying, once you go this far, it adds layers to that. Because if you don't even know really what you're trying to achieve or how you're going to achieve it, if it's really the case, as Donald Trump has said, that he was totally shocked by Iran's response in striking its Gulf neighbors, totally shocked, even though the Iranians had said that they would do that. And his own advisors, it's now emerged, had been warning him that was a risk. But if it got to the point where you're totally shocked by that, then your level of unreadiness has to be cast back to the morality of your original decision. And the Iranian response, particularly in the form of drones, shows that the wrong way to think about this is who's got the bigger, badder military. The way to think about this is, what kind of power does Iran have? And how might that be deployed in all sorts of catastrophic ways? And then the geopolitical consequences become, well, one, you could argue for Israel, fine, because a broken Iran is fine for Israel. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true until out of a broken system, all manner of unimaginable threats emerge.
Which we've seen precisely over the last 15 years. Yeah.
So that's one point. But leave Israel out of this particular equation. You now have proof of concept that Iran can destroy the oil market whenever it wants. We can just shut the Strait of Hormuz and it'll be a disaster for everybody and inflict all sorts of pain, particularly in America. Oh, we can just bomb our neighboring countries.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know how this ends. I suspect no one really does. And maybe that's my point, actually. But if the last thread of the moral justification or moral legitimacy here is, well, there's a geopolitical dividend, well, what if there isn't? What if there's a geopolitical cost in a way that was foreseeable had you thought about it? And I don't mean to reduce this in any way just to those crass calculations. I thoroughly take your point about the morally retrograde concept of just striking someone because you can to retain your dominance. Okay,
or
I accept that point.
But
if you haven't even got to the point of establishing that that would even be true.
No, that's right. Then we have the further failure of imagination, the belief that in much the same way as the United States has created a kind of vassal suzerain relationship with Venezuela, we can topple these people and put our people in, people who will operate in their own self-interest. The idea that something like that could happen, that Khamenei could be, quote unquote, decapitated and one of our people could take the reins, that they would operate on the basis of American-style self-interest. There is such a perfidious failure of imagination, to say nothing of geopolitical humility at work there.
Or care.
Or care. And look, the other thing we haven't even gotten into, our guest is going to have to help us out with that, is, you know, AUKUS places Australia in a very, yeah. very strange relationship with the United States. And, you know, there has been a certain care with which the Prime Minister and the Foreign Minister have both used the language of international law, have spoken about collective self-defense, have been quite restrained and limited in their own pronouncements. But this is also really complicated for middle powers.
We didn't even talk about the Australian response, did we? Maybe another show, maybe this one. Let's find out. You're listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens is my co-host.
Our guest is Tamer Morris. He's a senior lecturer in the School of Law at the University of Sydney, where he focuses on international law, thank God, the United Nations peacekeeping and international humanitarian law. He's also the author of The Protection of Citizens in Peacekeeping Organizations, A Legal Obligation. Tamer, welcome to The Minefield.
Hello, thank you so much for having me. You guys have covered so much ground, and I'm going to repeat Waleed's thing of, I don't even know where to start with this thing, because you guys went all over the place. Can I just like to add what you guys were kind of saying? I think what this is disturbing most people, and the people that I speak to, specifically non-lawyers, is that we've stepped away from legal language. So if you think of all the times in the past we've done this, states have tried to justify what they've done legally. Like, so in Iraq, 2003, even, you know, in the past when we attacked Iran, you know, the 12-day war, it was justified kind of under self-defense. This time we've all dropped that language. It's just been removed from our discussion base because it has become an issue of legitimacy. It's become an issue of they're bad, they're an evil regime. And to kind of mirror what you're both saying, it's also become very binary then in that discussion, which is, if you oppose this war, does that mean you support the Iranian regime? And that's just how it's been discussed constantly in our politics, in our newspapers, in this kind of very binary issue. And then the problem with that is, and relying on morality and specifically these kind of legitimacy arguments, is they themselves are contradictory and they don't stand up. And what's being relied on is solely a binary issue. If you oppose the Iranian regime, the only way then is to attack. Like, and that's kind of how it's being proposed, rather than, and forgetting that the reason we have these rules in the first place is to stop that kind of thinking. That was the purpose of these rules, was to stop states thinking this way. And we've just all opposed it. And I'll jump on the Australian response, where Australia just supports it. And when asked directly, is this or is this not illegal? Our response is, that's not up to us to decide. That's not important.
And that it's a question for America and Israel, I think.
Exactly, it was a question for America and Israel, which for me is problematic, because if you're going to say you support it, then you should ask first, is it or not legal? So I think part of the problems we're having at the moment is this drop of the legal language and drop of the legal justifications and a reliance on a morality. But then the question is whose morality are you relying on? Who decides this issue of morality? And just to bring it up, what I've been telling a lot of my students is, if your issue is this regime is terrible, they are killing people, how many people then are you willing to kill to get rid of this regime? Mm-hmm. And does that not make you them? If you're upset with killing, then why then are you killing? And this is where I said the moral kind of justification falls apart a little bit, because who's morality? Who's the good guy? Who's the bad guy? And should this determine world interaction and world international relations by simply, I think I'm the more powerful? That's one of my greatest concerns. Mm.
And that's before you even factor in the point, or maybe this is an extension of your point. Well, what if I point you in the direction of North Korea, for example? Why no intervention? Well, the answer there is simple: nuclear weapons. Okay, so what's the signal that gets sent to every odious regime that's repressing its people? Let's presume that there's a smorgasbord of them to choose from. Well, you just go get nuclear weapons.
Yeah, without the nuclear deterrent, you could be next.
So now what do we have? An incentivized nuclear arms race, particularly on the side of those that are most repressive towards their people? Is that what we're trying to? I mean, one of the reasons we have laws is that we try to think about what the long-term consequences are of action in the short term that might be inconvenient, and we try to cut off those consequences from the beginning And once you forget about that, that's a problem. So I take your point. But just on, can I just ask you, on the Australian government's response, is there an argument to be made that a middle power like Australia ultimately embarks upon a futile enterprise in trying to hold back the tide of the erosion of international law? It needs to, following Canada's cues and Mark Carney's speech, accept that we're now in a world where that's just not the touchstone, and calibrate its responses according to the world that exists rather than the world that they would wish to exist, and that therefore there was no point in them having an internationally legally informed response to these things. The only thing they could do was have some kind of middle power response. And then even if you don't like their response, your criticism or your evaluation of their response should be couched in those terms rather than anything to do with an international legal order that, well, has been abandoned.
So, look, my personal opinion is we as the middle powers specifically need to hold on to international law because that's the only thing really that protects us. If you think of it in a very kind of philosophical way, we are not a powerful state. We're just not. And so this might is right attitude, we can't rely on that. And so we as middle powers solely relied on international law that no one would attack us unless we are a legitimate threat. And so for us to say, let's just abandon this order because, you know, the middle powers need to be realistic, by abandoning it completely, we're then kind of letting ourselves into the jungle and not understanding the rules of it. And international law, I know everyone focuses solely on armed conflict and the rule of use of force, but international law still exists. Think of aviation, think of telecommunications, think of shipping. It still all exists. It's still running. It's how we interact with each other. What we're going
Shipping's
to
do. An ironic example.
I know. Sorry, the second I said it, I was like, No.
Look, I understand your point. I understand that argument. But I wonder what you make of the argument that's like, well, yes, but this isn't about do we support the abolition of international law. It's about, well, what do we do recognizing that that's already happened? So we're now in a world where that just no longer exists as far as the major powers are concerned. Do we keep waving the flag for this thing or do we adjust to that as a fact, whether we lament it or otherwise?
So you got two different ways you can think of this. So the first one is you think of it like domestic law. Just because someone breaks it doesn't mean the law's gone. So murders occur a lot in Australia, unfortunately, and assaults. Doesn't mean we should get rid of the law. Doesn't go, well...
But Tamara, you know the difference here. The difference is that still gets enforced. There's no enforcement mechanism except via the volition of these major powers who've demonstrated they don't want to volunteer for it.
Exactly. So one of the best enforcement ways, if all the countries came up and said unacceptable. So if we all came up and said unacceptable, and in my past life, I used to not be an academic and actually practice in law, that was one of the greatest enforcement measures against the state. We won't trade with you. We're going to stop it. You've broken the law. And so if we all stood up together, it would make it. But I do agree the reality is that no one wants to stand up to the United States. The problem with not standing up, though, is what is going to happen is it's not the abolition of international law. It's its shift. We're shifting it. So we're now saying this is legal because that's what the law is. The law is what we all accept as states to be legal. And so we've all now accepted this as the new legal regime. If we start accepting this and go, cool, it's over, this becomes the new legal regime. And that's really problematic for us because if we decide now any state could be a threat to any state and you don't need justification, simply I'm good, they're bad. And the example I always give is, and you know, you guys did bring up our relationship with the United States. If we get the submarines, you know, we've got these nuclear powered submarines that we're hoping to get delivered to us. Once they enter our waters, why cannot China attack and say, well, that was an existential threat to me and I'm attacking it and this becomes the new legal order. So why are we, I know everyone keeps going, just wave the white flag. Why we can't do that is if we do, the road we're going to go down is going to be very problematic for us as an Australian, as a middle power, because then it means might is right. And there's a lot of states who are mighty who we don't agree with and are not technically our allies. And so this is a very big problem. We just keep going, oh, the United States will protect us. That might not be true. That's what the Gulf states thought. They thought the United States will protect them, and it turns out not to be true. And so instead of waving the white flag, I think we need to hold down and say, no, this is the law, and what America is doing is a clear violation of it, to try to protect it, because the other road that we're going to go down is going to be very problematic for us.
You are listening to The Minefield on ABC Radio National. Waleed Ali is my name. Scott Stevens, my co-host. The voice you just heard there belongs to Tamara Morris, who's Senior Lecturer at the University of Sydney.
So once again, as the only non-lawyer in the room, I do feel like I'm on kind of, you know, I'm on thin ice.
Feel free to pivot, Scott.
I actually don't want to pivot. I actually want to go deeper on an issue that concerns me concerning law, but at a deeper moral level. So Tamer, Jerry Simpson, a great Australian international lawyer, had this really interesting half-critique of what he called the juridification of war. That on the one hand, entry into war is surrounded by all manner of, for want of a better term, legal casuistry. If you want to find justification, there are ways of finding justification, and that comes in part due to what Waleed often refers to as some of the promiscuous uses of certain legal categories, that terms like self-defense, preemptive self-defense, anticipatory self-defense, these are things that can be stretched in order to accommodate to a certain degree national self-interest. So on the one hand, you have the juridification of war in the lead-up to wars, in the entry into wars, and then you have the juridification of war crimes afterwards, where these things, international law really can't do the preventative work. All it can do is raise the barrier for entry into war and then do its best to punish people after the things have already been committed. I'm not saying that there's an impotence to that, there's a problematic aspect to that, but there is something about that that I think covers over or dissimulates some of the sheer bloody realities of war itself, which is, on the one hand, the declaration of war, the commission of acts of war, an act of aggression, is a display of strength, not against what one presumes to be one's equal, but against an opponent that one believes that one can, in fact, militarily best. In other words, war, almost by its definition, is a kind of war of the strong against the weak. And that then brings me to this troubling line that we're hearing increasingly recycled these days. It's this line is probably slightly mistranslated from Thucydides' Peloponnesian War, where one of the Athenian delegation says to a city-state against whom the Athenians will be easy conquerors, the strong do what they will and the weak will suffer what they must. The point, though, in Thucydides quoting that is that there is no justice apart from among equals. In order for there to be justice, there have to be two equal parties, two parties able to look at one another in the eye, able to command the other's respect, able to engage in a form of political or social or moral reciprocity. Here's my question about international law. You just raised the issue, what happens if the language of international law disappears? Isn't the point of law, of international law, not just to raise the entry level into acts of war, but also the creation of a system of international equality whereby nations, whether strong or weak, cannot help but look at one another in a manner that is mutually responsible, where there are shared and mutual obligations, and against whom, therefore, certain things that can be done that can rightly be referred to in terms of justice. In other words, that have a moral dimension. You have obligations here that your strength doesn't simply overcome. I guess the question I'm asking is, you know, we dismiss in some respects the impotence of international law, but isn't international law itself holding out, trying to safeguard a profoundly moral idea concerning both the nature of and the responsibilities that flow from equality?
Yeah, look, that's to start us off, just to kind of go in a weird way. So in 1945, that's when we decide to place the prohibition on the use of force. So for like the non-lawyers, to start a war. We, in 1945, we officially placed the prohibition. So before that, it was completely legal for states to use force. And as you kind of said, it was very much the weak to the strong. And the world realized that a lot of the times that was used for colonization. Mm-hmm. It was used for segregation. And it was something that the world after World War II went, you know what? We don't want this to happen anymore. And it was a moral decision of the world at the time to ban the use of force because it was the right of every state to use force. On an interesting kind of tangential understanding, in 1949, we write the rules of conflict, which is known as the Geneva Conventions, because I think we realized, look, people are going to fight anyway, even if we have the people are going to break this prohibition. But if you do, here's how you fight. And that's the Geneva Conventions that came in 1949. And so,
which, of course, are always observed.
Exactly. But even Geneva Conventions, I always tell people, because everyone's like, can you have rules to war? Can you have rules to conflict? And as kind of what you were saying at the beginning, it's the purpose of these rules was to protect certain things. And so, for example, the Geneva Conventions, their whole premise is if you're going to fight, fine, but you must protect those who are not participating, which is the protection of civilians. Mm. They must be protected. Why? Because they're not getting involved in this. If you want to fight, you can fight. But as you said as well, it was we had an element of morality and justice, which was even if you do fight, certain things are off the table, including territory. You can't take someone's territory from war anymore. You're not allowed to. And so we had all these kind of rules and a system that we set to kind of counterbalance what happened before that, which was colonization. Like, we were trying to counterbalance this idea of imperialism and colonization. And that was just kind of its fundamental understanding. And so, as I always say, the law was written assuming that everyone thinks they're right, that everyone thinks they're the good player, everyone thinks they're the moral person. And so we wrote the rule going, even if you all think you're morally right, this is what you can and cannot do in conducting your relations. And I think kind of what's the scary part of now of this separating what I'm going to call the moral argument from the legal argument is we've made this sense of morality more moral than the law. The law at the time was supposed to be the kind of the basic level of morality that we do and we function as states together, which is now being completely disregarded. And I'm not going to lie, it is giving me flashbacks, but I wasn't alive, but this kind of flashback of colonialism and imperialism. And, you know, but as you say, we're more powerful. We've got to exert our dominance. But that's what was done in the past. And that was morally justified in the past. And we decided that that shouldn't be any ethical standard that the world will win. It kind of exists. But we're going slowly back to this idea of, well, we think you're wrong. And that means we can break any rules that we want and don't even have to justify it under the rules.
Yeah, the critique of this is that for all that, the notion that this was some kind of, I don't know, governing arrangement between equals, or that this was constraining behaviour in actually effective ways, just was a fiction. I mean, you know, to some extent, Mark Carney acknowledges this in his speech. He doesn't do it in particular terms with respect to war, but we can perhaps glean that he might have been talking about that sort of thing. We can lament Trump's torching of the international rules-based order all we like, but it had begun long before. I choose to talk about Iraq a lot because I think it was such a significant example of it, but others will have other starting points. Scott may well have one that goes back well before even the Geneva Conventions existed. You can certainly do that in history. But what stood out to me about Iraq was that such a bad legal case was capable of sustaining not just a war effort, but the dragging of allies into that effort. And so where a case can be so manifestly bad and still that not be any kind of impediment to these sorts of things, then while I take your philosophical point, Tamer, and I understand that that theoretical description of the purpose of international law and what it achieves, I do wonder whether or not in the end the great power impulse predominates. And this was, I mean, in some ways it's embedded in the Security Council. You almost can't get a declaration of war done legally because all you get at the Security Council is the veto of opposing power blocks. And then that does come down to the idea that everyone thinks their side is right or whatever, and they will shape the meaning of the law and meaning of international authorization mechanisms and whatever it is accordingly. So, look, I don't want to overstate this. Broadly speaking, I'm on board with this idea that the death of the international order is to be lamented, particularly on matters like this. But I do wonder if sometimes in making that case, we can overstate what its achievements might ultimately have been.
So, look, I'm not, everyone thinks because I've got an invested interest because I teach international law, I must keep it alive. International law's got its problems. It always has. But again, I think all law has its problems. This issue of double standards exists in every legal system. Like in our domestic system, if you're affluent, if you are wealthy, you are going to get a much better outcome than if you're not. And that is, it's what happens. And so arguing, well, you know, certain people get certain standards, certain things are, you know, certain groups of society never get prosecuted, or certain groups do get prosecuted. That exists in law. It's unfortunately a problem in law, which needs to be fixed and needs to be addressed. And specifically, someone in a lot of my research, yes, people from certain countries are, you know, always get sanctioned, always get, while other states who do the exact same things, nothing will happen to them. That does exist in the law. But to kind of slightly defend it, if you go back to the Iraq example, I know everyone hates the veto power, but that was used very well at the time because, you know, United States tried to bring a resolution into the Security Council and they were blocked because the other states went, this is illegal. You cannot enter Iraq and we're not going to justify this under the Security Council resolution. And they couldn't get it passed. And so that's when the veto power actually worked for the benefit that America couldn't buy certain votes. And so certain states stopped them. It's now unfortunately being used incorrectly because, you know, Russia, United States are the ones violating the law and they're vetoing their own resolutions or any resolution that comes up. But at the same time, and maybe this is a philosophical kind of way of thinking, do we still not want them to even at least try to justify it under the law, to even think about the law? Because that as might stop them from invading another country. Because now without the legal parameters saying just remove it, states can do anything that they want. And just to kind of give the example, like I think it was the 11th of March. On the 11th of March, the United States actually submitted this paper to the Security Council trying to legally argue how they invaded or what they're doing in Iran at the moment. And it shows you that international is still not dead because they're still trying to use it. And so even though you can say it was maybe done in bad faith, I don't think it was. I think sometimes they are trying to justify what they're doing. And that's, I think that's a good thing. It's better than throwing it out the window and saying, well, now we're completely going back to before 1945, where you can attack anyone at will. I think for me, that's too problematic.
Oh, I just feel like it's the smallest fig leaf I could possibly, I didn't even know they'd made that argument, or, and it changes so little for me.
Really?
Well, the fact that I didn't know but, tells you how little
but hang on.
Consequence was attached to it.
Hang on, Waleed. There is an interesting difference here, though.
Mm.
So Harry Frankfurt has this famous distinction that he makes between someone who lies, and I'm just going to use this term in the philosophical sense, not in the vulgar sense, but someone who simply bullshits. Yeah. Someone who lies knows what the truth is, and they're doing everything they can to work around it or to evade its claim upon them.
They're trying to deceive. Yes.
They're trying to deceive because they know what the truth is. Someone who bullshits just couldn't care less. Now, I guess what's kind of interesting in the example that Tamara just raises is that there is something salutary, isn't there, about the consciousness that this both exists and that it matters. I mean, it's something I've been wrestling with over the last few weeks. You know, go back to 2003. Was it better? Was it worse that all these representations were being made to the UN Security Council? Was it better? Was it worse that Colin Powell delivered an impassioned case for the invasion of Iraq, even if the basis upon which it was founded was either fabricated or fundamentally sort of misguided? Is it better to go through the motions and to still pay a degree of homage to this thing that we believe that in some respects means something, that it could in fact represent something good in the world? Or is it better to be utterly unmoved by it, to be heedless in the face of whatever claim international law might make on the behavior of nations? I think, you know...
Yeah, you frame the question like that, and I will agree with you.
Okay, but a liar a liar is better than a bullshitter.
That I'm not so sure about.
Okay.
Once you broaden it to its broadest philosophical formulation, Scott, then it's a different sort of a thing. Yeah, I don't know. If in the end the liar is deeply effective, gets what they want anyway.
Yeah. But gets what they want at the time, because this is the way the kind of the law always works as well. As you know, we said at the beginning, the law is also about the after effects, what happens after. And so if you look at Iraq now, everyone will call it an illegal war. no one goes, oh, well, that was, you know, that was legal at the time. So it, always the effects after. So I always think of what is
but,
also...
But they said that at the time, didn't they, Tamer? I remember people...
Some states didn't. Like, it took a while right. for people to jump up and go, okay, now I think it's generally accepted. I don't know a single person that will argue it was legal. But at the time, there were people trying to make the legal arguments.
Yeah, but sorry, Tamer, you also remember that one of the things that also circulated around wasn't just the illegality of the Iraq invasion. It was the likely corruption. In other words, this is all about the fact that Dick Cheney has shares in Halliburton. This is all about access to oil. I mean, that was the thing that really enraged or inflamed the moral objection to the war, not the fact that this was something that violated international legal.
Yeah, look, and I think the slight difference between this and now is this isn't, it does show how fragile international law is, because all you do is need one person to go, well, I'm not following it, and then there's nothing really we can do about it. And
yeah, it depends who that person is, but yes.
Yeah, and there's nothing we can do. Like, and so when students always go to me, why don't we stop President Trump? I'm like, well, the only way, how do you want to stop him? Do we blow up the United States? And then that just creates more war and more death. And again, morally, we're being inconsistent. And so there is nothing we can do. And I do understand that. But I always think of the after effect. What happens after this war? How do we seek justice after the war? How do we seek justice for what happened? Well, we need a legal basis to do that. Because if you don't have a legal basis, then what do you've got? Nothing. And so nothing occurs that's wrong. And so to abandon the law now in the midst of this problem means you don't have it after. You can't rely on it. And so I kind of agree. If you've got the liar, you can show that they're a liar because you've got the truth. So you can use that after the fact and use it for justice and storytelling and truth telling. But if I don't have it and I abandon it now, then what do I have after?
I don't know how much consolation that would be to anyone in Iraq, for example. I don't know how much consolation it will be to anyone in the aftermath of Iran or even in its moment where everyone is just describing this as an illegal war. I mean, I don't even know if I've read anything that would argue the case about it. So I'm not sure about that. But where I do think there is a serious point to be made is that at least by going through the contortions, you might at some point have to call to mind some of the potentially disastrous consequences that international law is trying to prevent. Maybe. I mean, even that case is tenuous given what we saw unfold in Iraq. It's become incredibly tenuous in the Iran case because Trump didn't even bother complying with American law, it seems. I mean, as I understand it, I've not heard a good argument to the contrary. I'm open to hearing it, but he's meant to get congressional approval for these things. One of the reasons you get congressional approval for these things, that the wisdom of that process is it requires the case to be made and all sorts of questions to be asked and all the unintended consequences to be agitated and all these sorts of things. In other words, there is a way, it's a way of fortifying the thinking that goes into a war. And what we've seen, at least at this point in its history, unless there is some magical plan behind the scenes I don't know about, is that there wasn't much thinking of the really serious potential downsides of this that's gone into it. I can see the virtue in that way. But there does come a point where if you've lubricated the canons of law, of international law, that thoroughly, that it won't even do that. That you end up getting into the kind of, what was the phrase you used before, Scott? The juridification of war?
Juridification, yeah.
Yeah. You end up getting into that situation where actually it's just all about how can I get this to go through that hoop rather than how can I, or what do I do to think about the potential consequence this law is trying to prevent. Mm. Even there, I wonder if my very slight, and I admit it's very skimpy, optimism might be a little misplaced.
But that is what the law is. Like, and this is the problem, because then we have a problem with all law, because even domestic law, it's can I find a loophole for my client? Like, that's what I used to do when I was a corporate lawyer. I actually don't think there's something, I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think all humans kind of go, you know, where's the loophole? But at least they're thinking about the scaffold of it, the structure of it. Does it fit within this structure and can I argue something within the structure? Just because people are trying to push the boundaries doesn't mean I remove all boundaries. I think for me, that's where I failed at that next step.
Yeah, I can understand that point. All right, we're now out of time. They're the rules and we can't do anything about them, Tamer. That's the way it works around here. Note the difference is enforcement from ABC Management. Thank you very much for helping us out, though.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
Tamara Morris, Senior Lecturer at the University of Sydney, the author of The Protection of Civilians in Peacekeeping Operations, A Legal Obligation. Our guest for this week's edition of The Minefield, which is now at an end. You can catch us next week, of course. We'll see you then, but you can catch us anytime you like on ABC Listen. See you soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.